Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of November 2nd. This week we spoke with William Bowl, who has authored an article in the current issue called An Illusory Peace, Why Even Obama Cannot Stop the Culture Wars. We spoke to Mr. Bowl from his home in Massachusetts, and we began by asking him why perhaps the culture wars seemed to be ebbing as Obama took office.
Well, I think the main reason why some people were prognosticating an end to the culture wars was the economic situation we were in. That's what people were setting their sights on. That was the crisis, and people were voting that way too. So we had the financial crisis on Wall Street. We had the bailouts, and what all that added up to was a much greater concern with bread and butter issues like work and wages. I think there was a feeling that the public was losing interest in the culture battles over over issues like abortion and gay rights and the like. And then there was also Obama's own agreeable style. He seemed to be extending an olive branch to cultural conservatives in some ways. And that was another reason why people thought that we might be seeing a slowing down of the culture wars. And there were some very astute people who were expecting to see a much less fractious debate over these cultural issues. There was a piece in the American Prospect that was titled the coming end of the culture wars, and no less astute an observer as Sam Tenenhouse of the New York Times was speaking about the post culture war world, and he was speaking about that as recently as June. So there were reasons to see a shift. I think that it would have been hard, even as of June, to see how quickly the conservative movement would come back into the picture, and how sharply the battles over abortion and traditional values and family values would come back into the picture as well.
From the beginning of Obama's administration, maybe we can talk a little bit more about that time. Was there any social conservatives that did kind of reach out to Obama, or if Obama was extending the olive branch, that did take him up on an offer to try to get past some of these old battles?
Generally, I would say no. There might have been one or two soft cultural conservatives leaning that way who were high profile, but for the most part, I think that they were they were out and organizing against Obama from nearly the beginning. I think that they were confused for a few months after the election. But I talk about how in the piece I talk about how while some people were were counting down the days of the culture wars, the soldiers themselves were pressing their uniforms. And one of them was Gary Bauer, who's a one-time presidential hopeful on the Republican side, and he's a leader of social conservatives. He announced that the Obama administration was rolling back a generation of small incremental advances in promoting pro-life, pro-family policies. That was his quote. This was barely 100 days in office that Obama was in that he was rendering that verdict. In retrospect, there probably was very little chance of the conservative movement entering into some sort of a dialogue with Obama on these issues.
Yeah, I think a lot of media pundits said that there was this honeymoon period for the president, but one of the surprising things about your article is that, as early as April, you had somebody like Gary Bauer making these statements. So perhaps the public hadn't quite caught up, but certainly by this summer, it seemed that there was, certainly on the news, the Fox coverage of the town hall meetings, et cetera, there was a more visible, fractious debate going on, as you said.
I think that a turning point was the nomination of Sotomayor, to the Supreme Court. On the one hand, you really couldn't have expected a Obama, a pro-choice president, to go looking for a pro-life nominee. That would have been out of the question from, you know, I guess from the Democratic Party's standpoint. But at the same time, you know, there was hardly a hint of abortion partisanship in her judicial record, and I thought that there was more than a hint of moderation on the issue. So you thought that there might have been some sort of pause there as far as the social conservatives went and their response to the nomination. But you know, almost immediately the opposition of pro-life groups in particular was adamantine. You know, they leaped on her role as a, you know, as a board member of a multi-issue Puerto Rican advocacy organization that had you know, filed some briefs in favor of abortion rights, and they had very little to say, if anything, about the one really important case that she ruled on as a federal appeals judge dealing with abortion. And even that wasn't an important case, but it was the most important word that she had given on abortion. In that case, she actually sided with the Bush administration, ruling against pro-choice groups in a case involving USAID to family planning agencies abroad. So I think that was a turning point. And then you had, you know, the healthcare debate, which I think, in a way, shed even more light on where social conservatives are at in our politics today.
One issue that might be of interest to our listeners is, you know, you speak about the pro-life groups and their involvement in these issues. I think it can sometimes be confusing, perhaps to the untutored observer, to try to sort out these groups, because there are numerous pro-life groups, and some of them do have some ties to Catholic organizations, but others have ties to political organizations. I mean, were you able in your research to kind of determine where these groups are coming from?
I was looking generally at the, at social conservatives who were part of the political conservative movement. And I think that there are some pro-life groups, particularly the ones under the Catholic wing, I'd say, that do not, you know, make as clear an alignment as that. But I was talking about the conservative movement that we hear about every day in the news, and I was looking at, you know, how they were responding to the you know, to these issues of the moment. In many ways, I think that they were behaving much like political conservatives in general, and this really steps back a little bit from the article that I had done, but. But I think that political conservatives in general have been behaving badly. I think that there are a number of people who have pointed this out. You know, Sam Tannenhaus is one of them, who wrote The Death of Conservatism, and he's in many ways sympathetic to the conservative tradition. He makes the point, and others have made the point, that conservatives now seem to be defining themselves, you know, less by what they want to conserve than by what they, you know, hope to destroy, and that's not a very conservative ethic, you know, in my view. So that's, you know, that's part of the background here, and I saw it, and I thought that this was very much reflected in the healthcare debate. I mean, the pro-life groups have a legitimate place, very legitimate place in that debate. And what they've been doing is, you know, criticizing proposals that in their view, which is contested, but in their view would lead to government-funded abortions. And I think that's fair enough. That's their job. But, you know, they also expended quite a bit of energy crediting these fantasies about death panels that would somehow emerge from the optional end of counseling that was proposed as part of the Obama's healthcare overhaul. And then they started scaring up the protesters to turn out, you know, at the town hall meetings. I mean, these are the people who were showing up at healthcare reform hearings with guns. That's very much an example of social conservatives pretty much stepping in line with the wider political conservative movement. But I thought really what was most revealing was was the willingness, and the desire of many pro-lifers to derail health care reform, abortion aside, whether it had anything to do with abortion at all. And in my article, I mention an email which I received this past summer from my local pro-life organization, Massachusetts Citizens for Life, and the president had sent out an action alert, and she said that she thought that it was pretty much impossible to remove, you know, what she insisted were the anti-life underpinnings of healthcare reform. But she said that even if you could do that, the healthcare reform should be opposed by all pro-lifers. And the reason she gave for that had nothing to do with pro-life concerns. It had completely to do with the financial costs, you know, of what she indicted as universal health care. So, and I make the point in the article that this is an arguable point, but it's not a pro-life or family values argument. It's a Republican National Committee argument.
One issue is, you know, you talk about the abortion issue and how this has informed the debate. Yet the issue of economic justice in terms of health care doesn't seem to come up as much. But as you say, this is a key issue. Why do you think this has been neglected?
There does seem to be a lack of, and this is really that goes to the core of my my beef with social conservatives, you know, who I in many ways identify with. But there does seem to be a pointed lack of interest in any issues dealing with economic fairness and justice, and there are lots of social trends here that ought to be of interest to social conservatives, but they just simply haven't registered on the issues. And you know, one example I give is you know, divorce rates in the United States. You know, they've been tapering off happily, but the tapering off of the divorce rates in our country have mainly to do with a steep drop, you know, in those rates among the college-educated middle class, and that's particularly the affluent. But you know, family breakup is still a plague of many communities across our country, and particularly poor and working class communities. You know, so much so that a lot of researchers have started referring to the divorce gap, which is a gap along socioeconomic lines. So that's one issue that hasn't registered with social conservatives, that particular trend toward a divorce gap that runs along socioeconomic lines. But I'll say in the piece that, you know, you see a similar picture developing with abortion. I mean, you know, rates have been falling off. U.S. rates of abortion have been falling off significantly, you know, but not among women with low incomes. And that's a very serious problem. In one survey, you know, three-quarters of the women said that economic hardship was their main reason for getting an abortion. There have been studies, you know, making a fairly compelling case that social and economic supports, like the kind the government gives, correlate significantly with lower abortion rates. And then you have unwanted pregnancies, which have been surging, you know, among women with low incomes and waning in middle-class suburbs. And you don't hear from social conservatives on these issues.
Well, you mentioned that you have some sympathy with the arguments put forward by conservatives, so obviously you want them to be part of the debate. What can they offer that would be productive?
Yeah, you're right. I do have a lot of sympathy with traditional conservatism, and I start with that belief that conservatives have an indispensable role to play in our national politics. But, you know, they're important, and not just because of the power they've wielded over the past few decades, and not just because they brought us, you know, Ronald Reagan, in a nation that's more tax adverse and government adverse than it had been for a long time. They're important because they're the people who look to the past for answers to our current predicaments. You know, there's William F. Buckley's famous phrase, standing athwart history and yelling stop. You know, that's what conservatives do. They're the ones who are, in an ongoing conversation with tradition, or at least that's the idea. They're supposed to take seriously the wisdom of the past and apply that traditional wisdom to our world today. That's their job. And if any conservatives in particular should be leading the dialogue with tradition, it ought to be social conservatives. The people who are concerned with matters of faith, values, and family life. The economic conservatives can't be relied upon to uphold traditional values, so-called, because they're often more concerned with the free market than with the stability of family life. They rather like the social disruptions caused by the market and big business, or many of them do. But social conservatives have a different mission, and yet they're behaving as I think I mentioned before, very much like the rest of the conservative movement, which means they're behaving badly.
As you said earlier, the focus of your article really is the social conservative movements, like Focus on the Family, Gary Bauer's organization, mm-hmm. other such groups, and doesn't take up as much as some of the Catholic pro-life groups. But in many ways, the pro-life movement in this country is strongly identified with the Catholic Church. Are there ways that the church can make it, because while the church does focus on these issues of economic justice and care for immigrants, those sort of issues, is there a way that they can make their voice known or kind of pierce through this debate in a way to kind of bring this pro-family argument together?
Yeah, and I point out in the piece that in many ways the American Catholic hierarchy is an exception to everything that I talk about in the piece. Because they have made their voice known in the wider pro-life movement, and they still are. You could argue about how strongly a voice it is at the moment in terms of trying to push people back toward the economic issues that have such a huge effect on these cultural problems. We do have a tradition. I mean, we have a tradition of that, and I have seen it in my reporting over the years, in talking to Catholic priests and other people who are involved in grassroots economic justice movements, that they instinctively talk about the family when they talk about issues like a living wage. It's just part of it's just their nature. So I think that we have something to offer this debate, even if in many cases there isn't enough distance between Catholic pro-lifers and the more partisan strands of the conservative movement.
Well, the article that you've written again is appearing in our November 2nd issue, and at this point it's called An Illusory Peace. And we want to thank William Bull for joining us and for talking about this.
Well, thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.
Thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Check online for other features this week, including a review of the HBO series True Blood from Jesuit scholastic Jake Martin. We also have an archive article marking the 50th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. I want to thank Bill McGarvey, who provides music for this show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.